This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Melissa Hoover, Executive Director of the Democracy at Work Institute, a nonprofit dedicated to worker cooperative development and to expanding the worker cooperative model to reach communities most directly affected by social and economic inequality, specifically people of color, recent immigrants, and low-wage workforces. Melissa Hoover is here to tell us about the work of the Democracy at Work Institute to build better jobs and a fairer economy with worker cooperatives. Welcome, Melissa.
Thank you.
Would you begin by saying a few words about the Democracy at Work Institute?
Sure. Yeah, the Democracy at Work Institute is about 5 years old. We were officially founded in 2013, but our genesis goes farther back. We come out of the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives, which is the national grassroots membership organization for worker co-ops, which started back in the early 2000s out of regional and local grassroots organizing. Members came together and built a national organization. And the plan had always been to have a sort of a training institute, education entity that sat next to our grassroots member organization to support those members and others and to grow the movement. What really became apparent pretty early on in the formation of the U.S. Federation of Worker Co-ops was that there was a profound change happening in who was starting worker cooperatives and why. So if we sort of look back to the 70s up through maybe the early 90s, there was sort of countercultural impulse often animating the formation of cooperatives. Generally, people with options looking to create an alternative and sort of exit the mainstream economy. And what changed in the 90s was we really saw people who were locked out of good jobs and business ownership using worker cooperatives as a way to enter the mainstream economy, but on their own terms and in a form that they controlled and was intended for their benefit. So that required a whole new set of supports, a whole different orientation and mindset about what's needed to grow and expand the movement. And so the Democracy at Work Institute comes out of that and responds to that and attempts to sort of push that dialogue even farther.
Would you remind us how worker co-ops are different from more common businesses?
Worker cooperatives, I'll start with how they're similar to other small businesses. You know, they share about 75% of their DNA with a conventional small business in that they operate in the market. They produce a product or a service that people will pay money for. And they do aim to be profitable businesses. They are viable, sustainable businesses operating in the market. However, it's really their ownership structure that's different. So a cooperative is a business entity that's owned by its members. And in a worker cooperative, the members are the people who work in the business. And so, you know, the mission of the cooperative is to benefit those members. And so in a worker co-op, it's a business that operates in the market that's meant to benefit its members and is controlled by those same members. So cooperatives operate on a one-member, one-vote basis. And that can mean anything from collective consensus decision-making all the way up through, in very large co-ops, members voting for the board of directors and having some other forms of participation in the running of the business, but having a little bit more distanced role in the democracy, basically. So there's member benefit, member control, and then financial return to the members based on their economic participation in the business. So in a worker co-op, members will buy a share, which entitles them to that participation, both financially and in the governance of the business. And at the end of the year, if there are profits left over, workers share those profits. So those are the sort of fundamentals of the form. It's a shareholder-owned business, like a lot of other businesses, except those are not outside shareholders, they're inside shareholders. And I think that really makes all the difference for how they're sort of practically oriented. You know, one of the things we find in worker cooperatives is that when the workers are making decisions, they'll tend to maximize their pay within the possibilities of the business, give themselves better benefits, have more generous leave policies. You know, it's really a worker-centered form.
What are the advantages of worker cooperatives for communities that the workers live in?
I think many of them are, as I sort of indicated in the DNA with small businesses, many of them are the same as small businesses. They are locally owned businesses that exist to serve the needs of the community. I think more deeply than that, within the cooperative form specifically, we know that the one thing worker co-ops are really good at is retention. So they provide stable, long-term employment for their members. Worker co-ops have remarkably low turnover. In addition to serving a consumer base and providing a needed local good and service and being accountable to those consumers, they also keep local jobs local for a long time. And, you know, I think that sort of community anchoring effect is one of the things we're seeing start to erode as neighborhoods change, as larger corporations come in and gobble up more market share. Worker co-ops can be a counterpoint to that and a way to really anchor jobs and services locally.
What are the different ways worker cooperatives come about? What are the different paths to creating worker ownership?
I will take the opportunity here to plug the work of a colleague, Hilary Abell at Project Equity, has written a really great little primer called Worker Cooperatives Pathways to Scale, for those of you who are interested in going deeper into that. But I would say sort of in three ways. People start worker cooperatives themselves all the time. A group of friends or coworkers or community members come together, pool resources, maybe access additional resources to start a business, usually doing something they already know how to do or have identified as a need in their community. So the sort of typical startup route is one way. A second way is through the help of what's called a cooperative developer, which is typically a third-party nonprofit entity dedicated to supporting the growth of worker co-ops. So an example of that in your neighborhood would be the Northwest Cooperative Development Center, based in Olympia, but serving the whole Pacific Northwest. They provide technical assistance and help with the process. That's at one end of the spectrum. And then at the other, there are these sort of dedicated cooperative developers that really take a very strong role in incubating a co-op. The co-op developer might sort of serve as the entrepreneur in the first stage of development and recruit members to the co-op and then slowly over time hand off control. So that's sort of an assisted startup or an incubation route. And then a third way, actually, which is really growing, we're seeing this trend due to, I think, demographic shifts and growing interest, is converting a conventional business from sole proprietorship or partnership into worker ownership. So a business owner may retire and sell the business to their employees. We're seeing a lot of that happening across the country. And in that case, what you're doing is not so much starting a new business as taking an existing business and changing the ownership of it, broadening the ownership of it.
What resources does the Democracy at Work Institute provide for cooperative development?
Well, we do a bunch of stuff. The foundation of our work is building the field. So that's our, sort of our general mission, is to make it easier, faster, and better supported to start or grow a worker cooperative. So we provide strategic research on the state of the sector and state of financing so that we can better understand ourselves. When we first started, we didn't even know the number of worker cooperatives in the country, much less where they were concentrated by industry and geography. So knowing that now, we can advocate for capital investment, we can advocate for policy, we can use that research to really drive new development. That's one of the things we do. Another thing we do is train cooperative developers and cooperative members. We are launching this year the School for Democratic Management, which will be virtual for the most part, webinars, but also some in-person sessions to train cooperative managers and developers in the really unique aspects of governing and managing a worker-owned business. We also convene partners in the field to have greater impact together, so serve as sort of the backbone organization for a couple different collaboratives. One is the Worker Co-op Business Development Initiative in New York City, which is 14 or 15 groups, I believe, at this point. And we've gotten nearly $10 million of funding over the last 4 years from the city of New York to develop worker co-ops. And our role there is we sort of helped advocate for some of that policy change. But what we really do is bring together co-op developers to think strategically together about how we can have a greater impact. And then similar initiative, but national, is we work with small business, economic development people, co-op developers, exit planners around the country to catalyze this wave of conversion of existing businesses to worker co-ops. And that's called the Workers to Owners Initiative.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Melissa Hoover, Executive Director of the Democracy at Work Institute. Our topic is building better jobs and a fairer economy with worker cooperatives. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. Where does the worker cooperative movement currently stand? How widespread are worker cooperatives in the U.S.?
Well, worker cooperatives are a humblingly small part of our economy. There are about between 350 and 400 worker co-ops in the whole country. They tend to be concentrated on the coasts and in the upper Midwest, although they are growing in other places. And they also tend to be concentrated in two pretty clear sectoral areas. One is food production, food processing, food retail, restaurants, the sort of the whole food value chain. And I think that makes sense. I mean, cooperatives form in places where the market is failing, basically, and where people need to meet their own needs. So they tend to operate pretty close to material needs. The second place that we see worker co-ops concentrated is in the care sectors. So home care, child care, elder care. And again, that makes sense to me because that's a growing need, but it's also a place where the workers' investment in the job makes it a better job and a better service that they're providing, right? Literally, if you care more about your job, you will care better for the people that you're caring for in your job. And so we're seeing pretty explosive growth, actually, in the care economy. And there have been some scale-oriented initiatives. I think one of the things that's important to know, though very tiny as a part of our overall economy, worker co-ops are connected in a couple ways to really larger communities. One is to the broader cooperative community, so housing co-ops, agricultural co-ops, purchasing co-ops, like your local Ace Hardware store, we all share sort of the same form, the cooperative form. And so we connect to the broader co-op community on values, but also economically. And then we are also part of what's called the employee ownership world, which involves the range of worker-owned business forms, from worker co-ops to employee trusts, to ESOPs, employee stock ownership plans. Those tend to be larger businesses that are employee owned by virtue of the employees holding stock in the company. They're not necessarily always democratic, more democratically controlled, but they are part of a broader employee ownership community. So I think we see ourselves as intersecting with some much larger communities. And then I will say, you know, just in the last couple of years, we've seen large partners like unions, like local economic development officials interested in worker ownership as a way to achieve their goals, whether that's keeping local businesses rooted or advocating for workers or creating new sorts of bargaining arrangements. So I see a real moment right now where there's a great potential for scale as other partners begin to take up the form to meet the needs that they see or are addressing in the economy.
To what extent have communities most directly affected by social and economic inequality taken advantage of forming worker cooperatives?
I think the clearest place we can see this is in immigrants to the U.S. The massive wave of growth in the last 15 or 20 years in worker co-ops has been really led by immigrant small business owners. And so, you know, we see people who, because of discrimination, racial discrimination, language discrimination, economic discrimination, don't have access to good jobs. They may have access to jobs, but they may not be good jobs. And the only reason they're not good jobs is because someone has chosen for them not to be good jobs. So we see immigrants mostly in the service sector industries, so in house cleaning and domestic work, creating worker co-ops and saying, you know, these jobs can be better jobs and we're going to make them better by owning them and by doing it our way. And so that's just a really clear and distinct trend in our world. The other place where we've started to see some uptake of cooperative and some interest in the cooperative business form has been among small business owners, particularly legacy business owners and minority business owners, who may lack a buyer for their business as they're thinking about winding down their involvement in it. And so small business owners with little access to capital or other options may consider selling to their employees as a way to keep the business open, in which case the business owner benefits and the employees benefit because not only do they get to keep a job, but they have an ownership stake in their place of work.
So what has been accomplished so far in this converting of businesses from owners who are retiring to worker cooperatives? How large a movement is that?
Well, we don't know yet. We just started tracking data a couple years ago. So we know that this had been happening ad hoc and in really concentrated ways in some places around the country, particularly where there is what's called a state employee ownership center. So in states like Ohio, their employee ownership center came to be, I think, in the late 80s, early 90s, in order to sort of address the effects of deindustrialization and really try to keep manufacturing companies from shutting their doors. The State Employee Ownership Center in Vermont has had a similar kind of history and track record. And where we see a very minimal state investment, and in many cases these centers are unfunded or receive really minimal state funding, they can catalyze the retention of, you know, dozens of businesses a year, in some cases hundreds a year, stay in the state and convert to employee ownership. So that had been happening for a couple decades, and we had been seeing some conversions ad hoc. I think 2 years ago, we looked at the membership roster of the U.S. Federation of Worker Co-ops and saw something like 30% of its members actually were generated from the conversion of existing businesses. They didn't come from startups. It was a little bit of a heads up to us that this has been happening as a trend. And then in 2016, we pulled together all of the organizations in our field to say, let's work together and see what we can do to standardize this process, make it easier, get the word out, see if we can persuade lenders and investors to help financially support these conversions, and then see if we can convince philanthropic foundations to make a little bit of investment in the technical assistance and local economic development to take a chance on employee ownership as one of the ways to retain businesses. And in the 2 years since we have been operating as a collaborative, the member organizations in that collaborative, which are about 15, have completed 21 conversions, business conversions, which transferred over $8 million in assets from selling owners to the new cooperative owners and created 215 new worker owner pathways. So with just a very little bit of coming together and some strategic coordination, we've seen a real acceleration. And I think $8 million transferred in assets to 200 new worker owners is nothing to sneeze at. And I think if we have deeper investment from local economic development, we'll see even greater impact. We know, for instance, that the city of San Francisco has this legacy business preservation initiative to keep legacy businesses in the city and contributing to the character and economy of the city. And they're interested in using employee ownership as a strategy. And we've started to see, again, with just very little publicity, a pretty organic wave of business owners interested in this. So it's early stages, but I'm predicting that, particularly if local economic development takes this up as a strategy, we can see hundreds of businesses across the country in the next couple of years.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Melissa Hoover, Executive Director of the Democracy at Work Institute. Our topic is building better jobs and a fairer economy with worker cooperatives. Overall, how successful have worker cooperatives been as businesses?
Overall, worker cooperatives stay in business longer than their sort of counterpart small businesses. The caveat there is that they tend to be harder to start. So if they make it past the startup phase, most businesses, you know, if they're going to fail, they fail within the first year. And depending on sort of whose statistics you read, it's anywhere from 50 to 80% of small businesses that are started fail. And we know that worker cooperatives tend to make it to about the third year before they struggle. So that's, I think, a qualitative difference there. And then generally, and this goes to the point of better worker retention, worker cooperatives just have a much stronger survival rate than small businesses. I'm not sure that I have our most recent data, but our State of the Sector report, which we publish every year at institute.coop, shows the sort of the comparison between conventional small businesses and worker cooperatives. That said, I do think it's harder for worker cooperatives to access loans and investment. So that's in large part why they are more difficult to start.
How well are worker co-ops turning out in terms of worker democracy?
You know, I would say the great majority of worker co-ops that exist today have an extremely high level of participation by the workforce in the democracy. This may be a controversial opinion, but I'll put it out there. I think as we scale, we're going to have to develop a broader range of what we understand it to mean for workers to participate in a democratic business. You know, right now there is quite a range, you know, everything from workers participating in daily operations decisions all the way up to workers only electing the board or serving on worker-elected committees. So we do see a range, but as the form scales and as new partners want to use it for achieving their ends, whether that's unions or minority business owners or rural communities creating hybrid models where the workers may own part of it and the community may own part of it, I think we're going to need to get more flexible with our understanding of what democratic participation means. So to answer your question, there's really robust participation now. I think we don't struggle in the U.S. with that question in the way some other countries have. You know, there are examples internationally of the government, the federal government of a country investing in the worker co-op sector, and all of a sudden this sort of flourishing by number of worker co-ops, but them not actually being truly robust and democratic institutions. We don't have that problem here in the U.S. for the most part. But I do think that as we grow, we'll want to better understand all the ways in which workers can democratically participate, everything from giving input at the point of production, through serving on the board, through all kinds of new legal forms that we may not yet have experimented with, like employee trusts or various hybrid forms of ownership.
Would you say more about your immigrant cooperative initiative?
Yeah, so we looked around. As we were getting started, it was clear to us that immigrants were driving the most recent growth in cooperatives. So we knew that was happening. Part of how we responded to that and wanted to support that was to pull together a broader community in addition to the co-ops and the development organizations that had helped many of them get started. We thought it was important to have a dialogue with immigrants' rights organizations, with refugee resettlement groups, with immigrant education organizations to be able to say, we're working together here. Let's pull together and not have cooperatives sort of sitting off as an isolated little economic development strategy, but really integrate it into the broader conversation about the way immigrants contribute to the American economy, about the way we as a society welcome immigrants and support their business initiatives. So an example of this is in New York City, where I think 99% of the co-op started in the last 5 years have been started by immigrants and more specifically women of color. And looking at that and saying, well, the city of New York, in addition to financially supporting the development of worker co-ops, also has this Office of Immigrant Small Business Development. And effectively, worker co-ops are doing immigrant small business development. So we should be connecting to those resources and being part of that conversation about the needs and assets of immigrant business owners. So we've done that locally in New York, and we've also done it nationally, pulled together sort of a discussion and strategy group of our allies from immigrant communities, immigrant organizing, and the cooperatives themselves. And we've trained some cooperative leaders to become peer advisors in an immigrant-led peer advising initiative. And we are in the moment right now sort of strategizing with those partners about how to develop a cooperative that can form more rapidly, an immigrant-led worker co-op form that can form more rapidly and with a little bit lighter touch in the co-op development so that it doesn't take as long.
What would most help develop the worker co-op movement to scale up and move forward in the future?
So I see three pretty critical ingredients: money, policy support, and partnerships. So on the money front, you know, the continued partnership of philanthropy, both local and national, is really critical to build the capacity of co-op development organizations. But in addition, I think we need to see increased impact capital coming into our world. Capital is how businesses get started, and impact investing seems to have overlooked the profound impact that worker cooperatives have for their members and their communities. So philanthropic funding and capital investment, I think, are the first strand. The second is the engagement of local economic development officials, local policymakers, groups that really work to start, grow, and secure local businesses should be looking at employee-owned forms, including worker cooperatives, as a pretty ideal fit for the work that they want to do in building local economies. So the third strand is larger partners, so unlikely partners, like the National Urban League, which sees employee ownership as a strategy for retaining Black-owned businesses in communities that are rapidly changing. So everyone from the Urban League to large national unions like SEIU, which is exploring worker cooperatives as a strategy for its members in the service sector. With those kinds of partnerships, plus capital investment, plus local economic development support, I think that, you know, those are really the ingredients for scale. And then I think another really critical factor is the worker cooperatives themselves. They have been out there building their businesses, building their members, offering peer advice and support to startup co-ops, in some cases offering financial support to help other co-ops get started. And they're really responsible for the strength of this recent wave of growth in that they can actually share how it's done with new co-ops, with converted businesses. And they've also been building their own institutions of support, raising awareness for the forum, coming together to advocate and to share information. So I think you only need to look as far as your local worker cooperative in order to sort of demystify the forum and really understand how it's done, which I think has been a barrier to the growth of worker cooperatives, is people not understanding on a day-to-day basis how to do it, when in fact it's one of the most common sense things you can do.
What fraction of businesses as worker cooperatives are you aiming for in the future?
We don't have sort of a, 50% of the economy number or anything like that. We want to be a measurable part of the economy. We want to be able to, by any economic indicator, point to worker ownership and worker cooperatives and say, you can see us there. We are big enough to be affecting the economy and to be changing the dialogue about how things are done. I mean, I think for small businesses, it should be the form of choice. And we're aiming for that. We're starting with existing small businesses and then moving towards startups as we think about what our target goals are.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I'd like to encourage their curiosity and to check out our website, institute.coop, and read up a little bit on worker co-ops. If you're in a position to invest time or money in supporting the cooperative economy, I would encourage that. And if you're in a position to change government policy or advocate strongly for worker co-ops to be part of a local economy, I would encourage that. So I think there are any number of ways folks can plug in, and it probably starts with understanding the forum and being able to see it in action. I believe in Seattle you have several worker co-op entities, and there was an organization called Slice, which was advocating for worker co-ops in Seattle. I think they may have decreased their activity in recent years. But check out your local organizations and your local worker co-ops and get familiar with them so that you can be their champion.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Melissa.
Thank you, Diane.
You were just listening to Melissa Hoover, Executive Director of the Democracy at Work Institute. For more information, check on the web at institute.coop. Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to the podcast section of KEXP's website at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and at kexp.org.